This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, friends. It's your buddy, Michael Cruz Kane, and this is episode 3 of A Good Cry, a podcast about grief with me, Michael Cruz Kane. I already said that. Any hoots and hollers. We got some emails this week, and I just wanted to shout out some of the people who emailed agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. Trevor, Sam, Christina, Geraint. Thanks for your messages. I read every message. I responded to every message. And one more time, that email is agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. If you got thoughts, anything you think I should share on the podcast, a long list of compliments, send them, please. Also, I've got a show on October 23rd at Caveat in Manhattan and on November 7th at Union Hall in Brooklyn called Sorry for Your Loss. I'll help you come check that out. And now on to today's grief stuff. It's another poem today, 2 out of 3 episodes so far featuring a poem up top. This one from my dude and your dude, Alfred Lord Tennyson. Explain to me why the Lord is in the middle and not in the front, if you dare. Very famous lines in this poem. You'll recognize them when they come. Here we go. We're just doing the end because the poem's like 3,000 lines. I envy not in any moods the captive void of noble rage, the linnet born within the cage that never knew the summer woods. I hold it true whate'er befall. I feel it when I sorrow most. Here are the big lines. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. Going to hit you with those last two lines again. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. I mean, those two lines are so good that that phrase has lasted like hundreds of years. Is that true? Does that feel true to you? That it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all? Do you wish that you could erase that grief that you feel and just have a life without it? I don't. To me, those 34 days that I had with my son, even though we never played catch, we never had a conversation, we never watched cartoons together, I wouldn't trade them for anything. And the pain that I felt and continue to feel from that weirdly has taken on a sweetness, if that makes any sense. I love to think about my son and that time. Do you? Let me know. Send me messages. I'm interested in your thoughts. Not a fan of this poem? Today's guest, Aida Osman. She's the host of the podcast Keep It. She's a writer on HBO's Betty, and she's about to star in Issa Rae's new show for HBO Max, Rap Shit. I hope you'll check it out. Aida is brilliant. She's funny. She's thoughtful. And we had an incredible conversation about her brother Sam, about what it was like to lose him, what it was like to grow up in Nebraska. Also about how grief changed her. As she says it, she can handle a lot more things than most people her age. And that wouldn't have happened if Sam had died. How does grief change you? Do you wish it had never happened? Is it better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all? What do you think? This is episode 3 of A Good Cry. I hope it helps. Hi, Aida. How are you doing?
Doing well. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing fantastically great. It's nice to meet you. We've done just a little bit of chatting, and I think you're so nice, and I like you.
Yeah, the banter is up, isn't it? I'm actually really offended because I do a podcast too, and now listening to you, it's immediately obvious that I don't have a podcast voice and you do.
Oh, like, well,
you have the right cadence.
Not to compound your jealousy, but I did study to be in musical theater.
Like, you say that like it's not a fact you wear on your face and body and temperament.
Yeah, people can't see this. It's not a video podcast, but I am wearing an outfit from Hamilton that I purchased. Yeah. That I'm always in all the time.
He's also wearing a hat that has like a double flag, like an eighth note. Like he's like a really he thinks he's a musical note.
Eighth note. That's some jargon. Shit. That's some industry jargon.
Also, an eighth note. Double flag is a 16th note. This is really embarrassing. I'm so fucking embarrassed.
We can edit all this out. We'll start again. Well, that part was fun. So this podcast is about grief, as you know, or I hope you know, or it's a hell of a surprise if you didn't know. Do you have a story that you can tell us about grief in your life?
I have a story, yes. You know, this is actually my first time telling it in succession, so this will be interesting. But my brother passed away in 2017, and it's a insane story. So I'm from Nebraska, and I grew up in Nebraska. My brother was a nonverbal boy with autism. It's funny that I even call him a boy. He was a grown man, but, you know, sometimes we baby people who are differently abled, and that's a whole other podcast.
Your brother is older or younger?
He was, at the time, 2 years older than me.
Gotcha.
Yeah, differently abled. He was also epileptic, totally nonverbal, didn't communicate, like had his own language. And he loved being in the water. He loved swimming. He insisted on swimming every day. And he would have a helper, like a para, who was assigned to go with him to the YMCA. He and Sam were getting ready in the men's locker room, but Sam was so excited to get to the water, he ran out of the locker room while, like, the helper was still getting dressed. He was still getting ready to go out into the pool.
I got you.
But Sam was so excited to get into the hot tub that day, and he got in the water. And then by the time the helper had gotten out to the pool area, Sam was already in the hot tub having a seizure and was underwater when he got to him. They pull him out of the water. They try to resuscitate him. They let him finish his seizure because it's an episode that he has to finish. And there is a time after the seizure, which is called the like post-ictal time, where most people get really sleepy. They've expended so much brain power having the seizure that they need to have the next day to sleep, to rest entirely.
It'll last a day?
For most people, I've noticed it lasts a day. Like my friends who, even the non-autistic ones, would have full days of sleep after a seizure.
Okay.
But for Sam, he would sleep all day. But because he was a big dude, like my brother was big and tall and muscly and just like a brolic guy. And he was getting really combative in his post-ictal phase. So they sedated him. And because they sedated him and they put him in the ambulance, the EMTs came. They didn't rush him to the hospital because they thought that, you know, his seizure was over. What they didn't catch was because they'd sedated him, his body was not having the adrenaline response to the water that was still in his lungs. So he died from a secondary drowning, which is when water gets in your lungs and your body can't get it out, like can't cough it up, can't throw it up, can't, you know, do whatever it needs to do to get it out. The only reason I told you the whole story is because the death is very fraught with him being like a special needs person, people neglecting his special needs, and these very like quick lapses of misjudgment that led to his death. And I get a call, and my mom says, come to the hospital. Sam's in the hospital. And I ignored the call because my brother was sick my whole life. Sam went to the hospital like every few months. I was like 18 at the time, and I was with my friends. And I was like, Mom, I'm not coming. Like, Sam comes to the hospital every time. He's always fucking fine. It's not a big deal. I'm not coming. And then when I eventually went over there, when she said, it's serious this time, I walked in and Sam was just, you know, like his body was there, but he was attached to a ventilator and I just knew that his like whole spirit was not there. So it was a very quick succession of events, and yeah, it was a lot. Sam's death was a lot.
So he was basically like fine for him. He was at normal, like, and then in 2 days he goes from that to secondary drowning.
Yeah, everything was fine. He was going to the pool every day. He had the seizure in the hot tub, again, freak accident, and it's an insane story. It really is. And then when they take him out, there was just neglect. There was neglect on the EMT's part for not rushing him to the hospital. There was a lot of situations. There was neglect on this helper's part for not being there with Sam when he was out in the water. There's like all these people who failed to do their job in that moment, and the EMTs especially for failing to realize that they sedated him, which would stop the adrenaline from getting, you know, from him having that reaction of having water in his lungs. But he was hooked up to machines for about 2 days before we had to have that decision to be like, okay, Sam's not here. Like, we need to take him off of these machines.
And was that a decision that you guys, this, when my son died, I mean, it's not exactly the same, but it is similar in that people I've interviewed on this podcast before, a lot of them had like kind of a long time coming, right? Like, you know, my dad got diagnosed with cancer or whatever. And then like 4 months later, I mean, that may not seem like a long time, but to you and me, maybe it is, where like my son was fine and then suddenly was sick and then suddenly was basically dead. And then a doctor is sort of like, the way it was presented to us was like, you could keep him alive.
It's exactly how
it would be nothing. It would be like, it would be a bunch of machines keeping this person alive that the second you turn the machines off, he would be gone.
Yeah, it's fucked up because they take you into that little grief room and it's the most sterile, bright, fluorescently lit fucking piece of shit location to be in. And this doctor who is clearly busy and has to do his rounds, and you realize this is a chore for him to even have to sit down with you and take that moment out. Bro,
I get that so totally.
It's so fucked up.
We had a thing that I think about all the time and it still like makes me angry. There was a new doctor who we'd never seen before who was in the room that kept being like, so with your daughter, blah, 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 with your daughter. And I was like, it's my son.
Fuck you,
dog.
Dude.
And I, you know, also like, I get it. It's like that person probably has to have that conversation 50 times that day. Like that's, I don't know who that doctor is, but I guess there's like one doctor whose job it is to go around and be like, okay, Mr. Smith, your husband died. Mrs. Johnson.
Yeah.
Your kid's dead. To just
They're like Anna Kendrick and George Clooney and Up in the Air. Like the people who have to go and that their only job is to fire. Like this person's only job is to be the grief consultant or the grief, whatever.
Yeah. To be like the announcer.
Yeah. Yeah, the end of life person.
It's you. It's just you and your mom in the room?
It was me and my mom and my aunt who kind of raised my brother and I because my father wasn't in the picture. Big shock. And this is another layer to it that was so frustrating for me as like an American kid. My mother is African and has these very kind of like pious, staunch cultural understandings of the world and sees death as like this huge loss. Everything is ending. The world is ending. You're never going to see that person ever again, not until you go to heaven. And we also had an African doctor, which is such an outlier for being in the middle of Nebraska, but they were both talking about it in a very God-centric way. And, you know, that wasn't what I needed at that time. I was not of that understanding. I'm a 22-year-old in America. Like, of course I don't believe in God. That's not how I process the fucking world. So they were having that conversation and I was uncomfortable and I had to leave the room. So I wasn't even actually in the room when they told us that Sam was brain dead and that he wasn't going to be able to keep living.
Wow. So your mom and your aunt stays in the room.
Yeah, they both stay in the room.
Is your aunt also African?
African Muslims. They're both from East Africa and they're very pious. Like they're very, very Allah is everything women.
Wow. I mean, that's also another podcast. There are going to be like five podcasts that we have to spin off of this episode of this podcast. you said you weren't in the room, but did you know? Like you knew.
I entered the room and then I left the room halfway into the announcement. But when I got to the hospital and I saw Sam just attached to all these machines and I said that I knew that his spirit or his soul or whatever my definition for it at the time wasn't in the room. The nurse pulled me aside, which is, I think, so fucked up now that I think about it because I was a child. She pulled me aside and she went, your mom and your aunt are frantic. Like, she was clearly stressed. And she's like, your mom and your aunt are frantic. You need to be the one to tell them this information. You're the only rational one in this situation. And I immediately internalized that burden immediately. And I was like, oh, I'm not even allowed to have emotions right now. The nurse thinks I'm the only rational one here. My mom and my aunt are wailing. Like, I need to figure out quickly how to grow the fuck up and explain to my parents that this version of death that Sam has experienced, this brain death, this hypoxia, is equal to being dead and that we need to reckon with that. And was very quickly like, not myself, had to be a whole other person.
There's so much to that I recognize. Like, I don't think anyone would put that on me, but I have a similar thing of like feeling like I've got to be the rational person, which eventually... Yeah. With my kid, like, eventually I broke. Like, you know, I was, like, trying to be, like, the solid person so that my wife could have, like, her reaction to it. And that wasn't her making me do that. That was just, like, how I operate.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was like for you, but there was, like, a crack moment where it's, like, oops, my entire, like, facade of my own neuroses has now exploded and I'm not able to fuck. Like, give me, like, I just need 8 hours of nobody talking to me so I can just, like, try and get myself back together and then I can operate again.
And I'm thinking for you that there is this whole level of like masculinity and burden that you have to carry as the father, you know?
Yeah, father. I mean, for sure there's an element of that where seeing my dad walk into the hospital and being like, I mean, this is a dark thing to say, but to be like, he wouldn't have let this happen to me. You know what I mean? There's like that element of it in your mind where it's like, isn't anything I could have done. Like the logical part of me is like, what were you going to do? Like operate on your own kid who was completely not sick 30 hours ago. Mm-hmm. But it's that definitely lingers, that element of it.
There's so many levels of guilt, but you were just saying something that I thought was interesting. So when I realized that my brother had passed, and we were sitting in the room, I remember I was like kneeling on the floor. I couldn't really sit. I was nauseous. I looked at the doctor and I was like, I need to talk to someone right now. Like, I don't know what the fuck you guys need to do in this hospital. Find me a mental health expert. I know there's one here. Send me to that floor. Send me to the psych ward right now. Like, let me talk
to
someone.
Strap me up. Let's go.
Let's go. Straight jacket. At least I'll be warm. It's freezing in here. Put me in a straight jacket. So they send me to the fifth floor, I remember, which was where they had quite literally the psych ward. And I talked to a mental health expert about everything I was going through. That was my 8 hours of being alone. Like, I just needed to talk to a person who had my foundational education and understanding, because my mom and my aunt don't think mental health even exists, or that you need to talk to people about it.
Had you been in therapy or whatever before that? That just seems like such a mature decision to be like, hey, I know right now that I need someone to take care of me.
You know when you're in a grocery store and you're looking around for an ingredient and you can't see it anywhere, and you could just like go through and walk every single fucking aisle, or you could find someone in that moment?
Right.
And I immediately was like, okay, this is my grocery store. Like, let me go find someone who fucking works here. Let me stop trying to look at my grocery list and make this recipe myself and free ball it. Like, let me just go find someone.
You went straight in that moment to like a multi-layered metaphor.
That's my skill, because I don't know how to process things. I have to make it something it's not. But I found someone and they talked me through it, and I came back with the tools. I think I was equipped to be like, okay, guys, we got to pull this plug, man. We can't leave Sam here.
So it was like the nurse talking to you, you going to see this like counselor, and then back in it with your mom and your aunt.
Yeah. And then we had the grief room, that cold room. And was yours like a closet too? Mine was a very small fucking room.
It was a pretty small room. There was a window. And the thing that I remember about it every time I think of it is that my son's name was Fisher, and there was a fish tank with a fish in it, like right behind the doctor who had done the operation, who also was, huge coincidence, African.
Wow.
So we were in a small room also, with like, there was like a little window, but you could just tell what the hospital prioritizes. No knock on the hospital. It's like, the most important thing for us is not making sure that you people are okay. We want our doctor to get the fuck out of there and go operate on some other people.
Yeah,
like that's what needs to be happening. And it makes sense. Like, the hospital, you know, on the one hand, needs to take care of people mentally as well, but primarily they're trying to make sure they don't have to have that conversation again. So all the big rooms are dedicated to that.
Yeah, no one, like the officials or the people who give the hospitals money, don't come in like, oh, how's your grief room? Is it good? Is it spacey? Are things checked out? No, they're like, do you have all of the scanning machines and all the things you need? You know, like
I love that also your level of articulation about this has been so like 100% this entire time. And then when you tried to think of hospital equipment, you were like, the scanning machines or
the kitty cat machines and the EPGs.
Where do you keep the beep boops and the
the bop bops? Words aren't, you know, weirdly enough, as like a writer and talker, speaker, words are not my specialty. Like, it takes me time to think of things.
That doesn't seem true. You were, I assume, close with your brother?
We were as close as you can be with a sibling who is nonverbal and autistic. Like, I loved him. I took care of him. I was always around him when I could be. But I know I held a lot of resentment for him growing up, and a lot of like looking at my mom like, pay attention to me. Why aren't you paying attention to me? But I was also like, oh, you have a sick child. So maybe I'll cut you some slack.
Yeah, I mean, that I would imagine I didn't have that. Well, my brother had cancer when I was a kid. And so there was definitely an element of like cutting my parents slack, but also being like, can we stop getting him water? Like he's not thirsty anymore.
Yeah. That's really funny.
When I think of the relationship between a differently abled sibling, like I think of that relationship being kind of like romanticized in movies. I'm thinking of like What's Eating Gilbert Grape or like whatever movies mm-hmm. like that, where like there's a very specific dynamic that's replicated in every movie. And there's part of me that wonders like if that is replicated because it's true. It is like always this version of deep love, protectorship, and then also a little bit of like, can you just be chill for a sec so I can do this other stuff?
Gilbert Grape was a perfect example because there was Johnny Depp's relationship to the kid and then there was the sisters and their relationship to the kid.
Right.
And I rode that relationship, the sisters. I was like, God, he's such a fucking burden. Like, mom can't come to my violin concerts because Sam starts screaming in the back row. Like, I can't have a mother because Sam needs twice the mother. Like, it was so much for me to process at a young age. But then it's also that thing that, like, you know how Johnny Depp's character is a protector and he's very mature and has to know way more. Like, unfortunately, I think Sam's condition and Sam's death even is the only reason I am the way I am. Like, I wouldn't be this person had I not experienced what happened with him.
What do you mean by that? That's a profound thing to say.
I want to think that I'm a smart person or that I'm a talented person, but I mostly think that people's ability is like something that they've acquired as a response to their environment and the things that have happened to them. Like, grief changed me. Grief made me someone who knows how to compartmentalize emotions. Grief made me someone who like can handle a lot more things than most people my age. And I know that to be true about myself, but that wouldn't have happened if Sam didn't die. And that wouldn't happen if Sam wasn't someone that I had to like look for in the middle of the night because he ran out. Like, I learned empathy from having a brother with special needs. So yeah, if that makes sense.
that makes complete sense. I mean, it sounds like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there's like, you're required to mature faster in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Because of the experience you had. One, even if your brother hadn't died, but then obviously, like, there's like an exponent on it because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I grew up in like, in Dragon Ball Z, they have these hyperbolic time chambers where you like go in and you come out 1,000 times better. And there's, cause like, it's so much pressure. It's so much pressure to be in third grade and have to explain to your principal why your brother brought a syringe to school and why he's about to get expelled because he brought a syringe, but it's for his medicine. And you have to explain that to them. And you have to explain that, like, you know, and there's a whole added layer of, I was a black family in a white school and was having to teach people about my brother's condition and also about our blackness and why they were acting that way toward us. But it also there's the like Muslim thing and then Sunday right. school. And even in Sunday school, we were the only black Muslims. I was surrounded by Arab Muslims. So it's just all this shit that you get put in, again, this time chamber. And it's like, okay, grow the fuck up. You're the only one. We get it. Like, that story's old. You're the only one. Ha ha ha. Move on. Right. So Sam's death didn't even shock me. I was like, of course this would fucking happen to me.
Did it really felt that way? I felt like inevitable, not like maybe that specific thing, but it's just like so many things there have been so many hurdles erected. I don't even recognize, like, new hurdles are nothing. Is it like that kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to talk about it because it sounds haughty and it sounds like self-serving to be like, because it lacks, you know, honestly, it lacks objectivity to be like, yeah, bad things happen to me all the time, so I know how to deal with them. Bad things happen to everyone all the time. They know, they too have to learn how to deal with them. But it's always felt like my life is defined with major loss. And it feels like it's been a theme. You know, you like read a short story and the theme pops out very easily. Like, for me, grief and recoup, like finding a way to deal with what you've been dealt has felt like a theme in my life. So I would say that.
I think that thing you're saying about lacking objectivity is so interesting to me because grief in a way can also like obliterate even like the notion of objectivity. Like this idea that there is this universe in which we all live, when you're operating in sadness that you feel like nobody else has, that you're like, oh, I am the only person in the world, actually. It's just me. Or it's just me and my wife. Or it's just me and my mom. There is nobody else who sees what we see. My son died. That's the worst thing that's happened in the history of the world, mm-hmm. which is how it felt for a while before you like are able to retreat, like look, see the forest for the trees and be like, oh, you know what? Bad stuff has happened to other people also.
Yeah. And like immediately at the time, I didn't know how to grieve death. Like, my grandma had died and that was fine because grandma's died. That's what they do. Like, that was easy for me to process. But my brother's death was different because I always felt like he would get sick, but I, in my head, had always grappled with, I'm going to raise Sam forever. Like, even after my mother passes away, I'm going to be the one that is responsible for Sam's life and Sam's well-being. And that kind of scared me. And there were moments where I would ask myself, like, is this really my life? Like, am I going to be 40 taking care of another 40-year-old? Is that going to be me forever?
Yeah.
So in that way, I didn't expect Sam's death because I was fearing his life. But
yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah,
it's
man.
It's a lot.
I mean, I think that, well, I also, so much of what you're saying strikes me as like so, like exactly pinpoint true. Like, I didn't have that experience. Like, you know, my son was only alive for 34 days, right? But
yeah,
when he got super sick all of a sudden, there was a period of time where they were like, even if he recovers from this, which he almost definitely won't, he will have a very hard life that will require being tended to forever. And so there is that, like, that time where you're like, what, like, where you project that life forward. And that's part of the calculus, I think, when eventually they're like, you could try and keep him alive forever and hope for a miracle. It's like, if we roll the dice on that, we're prolonging this suffering to maybe get him out of here so that he can suffer forever.
Yeah.
Which is like, at that moment, not that I wanted him to die, but there definitely is a time where you're like, this is a release for whatever, for like this living person, if the choice is maybe better this way.
Yeah, I experienced that 100%. And in fact, I had to get to a point where I told myself, like, you never wished for Sam's death. You can't allow yourself to think you wished for Sam's death. You might have considered a world where you didn't have to take care of Sam, and that looked nice for a moment. But ultimately, at the core of that was like, no, I need Sam around. Like, you can play with those ideas, and you can feel joy from them even. But I had to stop feeling guilt about not feeling grief. I had to teach myself to undo all of this. And to your point earlier, like, I didn't think anyone was experiencing what my mother and I were experiencing. I was like, who do I know that has not only lost a sibling? Like, who the fuck loses a sibling at 18? I don't know anyone who had in my neighborhood or my city. And then on top of that, who loses a sibling who has special needs? There's so many layers to the burden of that. Like, you feel this release off your shoulders too. Like, I even look at my mother now, who is pursuing like everything she's ever wanted to pursue in her life. All of the happiness that I'm seeing because she has all this time freed up because she's not taking care of Sam. So you have to do this bargaining all the time, every day. Like, you see your mom in this beautiful painting she's made, and then you go, yeah, you wouldn't have made that shit if you had to feed Sam every day. So it's this game that I'm constantly playing with myself of guilt. It's like a guilt game.
Yeah, and like you say, you don't think you'd be the person that you are. If you, like, Sam survives,
mm-hmm.
where do you think that, do you think about where that puts you? Do you ever imagine that?
It's fucked up, dude. It's really, because like Sam died. So I took my bereavement. I was studying philosophy and English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And it was actually horrible timing because I was taking a class about death and grieving and reading a lot of like Susan Sontag and a lot of Joan Didion and trying to process death all the fucking time, even prior to Sam's death. So I was like, I'm not fucking going to school and writing essays that are way too poignant for me right now.
Yeah, exactly.
So I took a week of bereavement, and the bar that I actually worked at was doing a stand-up night on Mondays. And I was like, I'm not doing shit. I could try stand-up. And I got on stage and I just talked about Sam's death and made a lot of jokes about it and felt release for the first time. And then I was like, I'm going to pursue this. I'm going to pursue comedy. Like, there's no reason not to. You can just fucking die in a hot tub one day. Like, why would I not pursue comedy? And I graduated, I think. It's still up in the air. another podcast. I graduated and decided to just move very abruptly to New York and pursue what I wanted to do. And luckily, it's kind of worked out. I'm in LA now writing for a TV show I love. So even though it's all on Zoom, like, I wouldn't be a comedy writer. I wouldn't be here doing this podcast with you. I wouldn't have had this connection if I didn't pursue comedy because Sam died. So I owe him a lot.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road.
With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Do you still, you said when we first started recording that you don't really talk about this that much. Do you still do stand-up? Like, do you, or that, does that energy shift into like a different thing?
I do not talk about Sam anymore. That's why, when we talked, when we started this podcast, I was like, I've never even told this story in quick succession. Like, the story of Sam in the hot tub and the EMTs and the grief I felt after it. To this extent, I've never talked about it. Probably not even with myself to recount all the details. I've tried. And it's not that it hurts. It's always like, what for?
Yeah, right.
What for? But if that answers your question.
Do you feel like the way in which you think about Sam's death, I mean, obviously it's changed from the way you thought about it at the moment that it happened. But like you said, it was 2017, right?
Yeah.
Has that morphed in any way into some other perception of it? How is the way you process that changed or changed you since then?
Well, day one, I remember the very beginning, it's no sleeping, no eating. I accidentally watched Mulan, which is a bad decision because now I can't watch Mulan. Like it immediately.
Oh, Mulan's ruined for you?
It's fucked up. I should have watched Born Ultimatum or some shit that I don't care about I could have put on. But now every time I hear Reflection, it's like, turn it off. I'm going to cry. So I watched Mulan and I was having random panic attacks and I already suffer from anxiety and suffer is the wrong word. I'm already dealing with anxiety and trying to cope. I know, right? Language frames thought, blah, blah, blah. So I was having these random panic attacks and I was taking bereavement, even though I saw it as a weakness. Like I really was like, come on, bitch, get up, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, whatever the fuck you have to do, get up, get out of bed, figure this out. But
and that's also that nurse kind of like putting that on you a little bit too, right?
Yeah. It was also myself. It was also me being like, the story that I had told myself my whole life was that I was a resilient, rational, non-emotional young woman. And that I saw women and I saw having emotion as a weakness. So I aligned myself with what I thought was the strong thing to do, which was to be logical. So that was like, of course, I was bottling everything up and I was having panic attacks. And when I went back to class, I was in this illness course and we were reading about Audre Lorde, who had breast cancer and had to get a mastectomy. And we were talking about that a lot. We were talking about hospitals and all somebody brought up was a ventilator. And immediately I had a huge panic attack in class. And so that was like the first few weeks. And in fact, I had that really fucked up situation. And I bet you can, I bet this might be resonant with you too. Sam died in water. Like I had the very unique position of being triggered by breathing. Like if someone took a deep breath, I was like, fuck, Sam couldn't breathe that one time. Or like,
if
I had to take a shower, if I had to be around water at all, I was immediately triggered. And that was just, I was constantly being met with Sam's death every single corner. So I didn't know how to deal with it. So those were the first few weeks. But yeah, what was it like for you, like right after Fisher passed?
Right after, I mean, it's sort of like a blur. Everything felt, funny's not the right word, but everything felt crazy. It was like, everything that happened, like you would, people driving by in their cars just seemed absurd. Like, where are you going? Where are you going to go right now? Just everything felt absurd. And I definitely remember that thing of like random stuff will trigger you. For me, it was like, it could be absolutely anything. It was not as logical as, breathing. Okay, well, my brother drowned. So there's a line you can draw directly to those two things. For me, you'd just be listening to the radio and like someone would be like, turn the radio up. And I'd be like, oh yeah, the radio. Oh my, like... For no reason, I'm like, this song is for Fisher, where it's like, what the fuck? What are you talking about?
That's so funny. There's a, you reminded me when you were talking about this. So there was a book that we used to read in school. It was like a one of those Newbery Medal winners. It was called My Brother Sam is Dead. And it was some revolutionary book. Yeah, it was this revolutionary book. It was like a young adult historical fiction novel that we had to read. And I remember being in like third or fourth grade and constantly being like, like My Brother Sam is Dead. Because I had a dark humor. I always had a dark humor. I always played with that shit. And I remember right after Sam passed, immediately thinking of that book and going like, did I manifest this? Like, did I joke about it too much that this happened? Did I secretly wish my brother's death would happen? You know, and there, I don't know. There was, I'm probably sounding crazy now, but I.
Are you kidding me? That's okay. Same. I would tell, I mean, again, like before I was like a comedian and I was just like a funny person in the office.
Yeah.
I would tell jokes about like dead babies. That was like a dark, you know, like a source of dark humor all the time. So it definitely is like a memory to be like, oof, man, would you tell that joke today?
Would
and,
you? Yeah.
And the answer is probably not. But like mostly because it's like it's not a funny joke.
Well, it's again like, and there's this other level of grief that I'm just figuring out now is that when you lose someone or something, there is this immediate pressure to turn that into like a palpable thing. Like when Sam died, my mom was like, it's okay, we'll make a scholarship, we'll make a foundation, we'll make something for him. And I'm like, I'm not ready. I can't meet you where you're at. Like, I'm not ready to do things that are in Sam's name. And also, why is there a pressure to do that? Like, I don't know how long it took you to get this podcast going, but I mean, and I hope that you can probably assign some like...
Only took 10 years.
See, like, it takes so much time to be ready to create a product. Like, this is the first time I'm talking about Sam's death in a public way. Like, other than that one little rinky-dink stand-up set I did on a stage to like four MAGA hats. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no... I rarely talk about this. So I was feeling a lot of pressure. And even now I'm like, okay, well, do you have to like write a book about this now? Like, do you have to make some crazy HBO, weird, eccentric, like a 1 hour special that investigates grief in a cool way with music and puppets? Like, but no.
Oh, you're going to say no. I'm surprised. I thought for sure. Definitely. You're like, that's what I'm working on. I'm working on a puppet show about this.
Wouldn't that be crazy? Actually, maybe this is an idea. I'll be like, what's the movie I'm trying to think of? Is it Being John Malkovich?
Being John Malkovich is a movie.
Yeah. Let me say that again. Edit this out, Houston. I'll be like Being John Malkovich.
we're keeping both those in for sure.
Houston, take it out.
Houston!
Fix it in post-production.
You're saying about like that thing you're saying about like feeling like you have to make content about it. I don't know. I didn't feel that exact thing, but I definitely felt like every year on the anniversary of his death, I would like write something. But then there's also like, should I get a tattoo or should I? Like, it's like, what's the thing that I can do that is enough? What's the thing that I can do that'll be like getting a tattoo felt like trivial. Be like, oh, I guess I got a tattoo of my kid. Like now he's happy in heaven or whatever. It's I don't think he would give a shit.
Because I'm like trying to figure out, I'm like, what is my tears in heaven? Like, what is my amazing piece of work? So I did. I got the tattoo. I'll tell you this. And I got the tattoo on my legs, and it was supposed to be this grand metaphor. I got the years that he lived and died in between my legs, and I was like, it grounds me. His life grounds whatever. Some bullshit I made up at 18 or 19 to justify wanting to get a fucking tattoo. Like, that's literally all it was. So I have this tattoo, and I promised myself, I was like, every time I look at this tattoo, I will think of Sam. It comes to be that I only really look at my above the knee tattoos when I'm shitting. So it's like there really is like, I only grieve my brother when I'm taking a shit. Cool. Love that for me. That's wonderful.
Well, at least you do that every day. Every day, that's something that you do.
On good weeks, I do that every day. Yeah, definitely. But a tattoo can't be stupid if it's in remembrance, no matter what it is.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Mm-hmm. Were there anything like funny or like weird that happened during that time? I feel like when people think of grief, they think very specifically of just like abject sadness that is cascading eternally. Were there any moments in there where like you and your mom had a laugh or like you and your friends or whatever?
This is still dark, but was funny for me, probably not funny for other people. But the day of my brother's funeral, I was like going through my closet, trying to find something to wear. But I was like, let me find my best black dress. I knocked the dust off it, put it on, went downstairs, looked at my mom, who is sitting on the couch, not ready to go. And I'm like, let's go. Like, are we going to this funeral? And she just looked at me and left. And she goes, Muslim women can't attend funerals. We're not going to Sam's funeral. What are you thinking? Like, astaghfirullah, alhamdulillah, starts saying all these things in Arabic that are like, how dare you not know your religion enough to know that women aren't allowed to be at funerals? And I stepped back and I started cackling. I was like, oh, this bitch is fucking crazy. This shit is crazy. Like, I can't be at my brother's funeral. You're fucking insane. This is not happening. And I just went to my room and I started laughing. And I, for a moment, was like, am I going to sneak into the funeral? What do I do? And it forced me to figure out what my attachment was to Sam's body. Like, I had no time to even process that I wasn't allowed at my brother's funeral. I had to be like, okay, well, what is a corpse anyway? Immediately.
So you did not go?
Did not go to Sam's funeral. Planned his like celebration of life, but was not allowed. Well, no women were allowed at his funeral.
So wait, when you say celebration of life, that's a separate event.
I had a whole separate event where we like had music, and I guess I just tried to turn it on its head and make it. I mean, people do this. People do this in everywhere. But yeah, we played music. We spoke in like the language that he'd created, because he did ASL, kind of like sign language, and ascribed his own words to things. So we just had fun. Like, we made fun of it and let go of a bunch of balloons. We littered a lot.
A lot of litter.
A lot of balloons in the air. Don't know where they went. So it was good.
Wow. I don't really know anything about Islam.
It's okay. Neither do I, clearly.
Were you religious like as a kid and then it kind of faded off of you? Or were you kind of never really into it from jump?
No, I didn't like it. I was like, right away. This man in the sky said this thing about, he don't even know me. Like how, I was like, who is this man? But it was also like, even now I'm so attached to the customs, the ones that I really cherry pick which ones I like. Like, I like fasting for Ramadan and I like the community of it, but I do not believe in what my mother believes in. Gotcha. So yeah, but it was news to me to find out that women weren't allowed to be at the funeral. I had never heard of that. I was not taught.
I mean, I didn't know that either. Among the other trillion things I don't know about Islam, which is another podcast, Things I Don't Know About Islam.
It might even be in my specific sect of Islam. I'm really not quite sure, but I know that that's a common experience.
Do you talk about Sam with your mom still? Like, is that something when you go home that you talk about frequently, or is it kind of like...
Taboo. Well, like I was saying, that the first few weeks of grieving was a lot of intense, visceral, like crying, you know, that very cliche, it comes in waves, I couldn't breathe, all that. Then year one was like thinking about him nonstop all the fucking time and not talking about it with my mom. Like, we were just, it was too painful. And every time we brought him up, we would cry a lot. And then year two was like, I stopped thinking about him and was starting to feel guilt about that. And then year three, it's like, I don't think about him every day. And I also don't feel guilt about him every day. It's really just like kind of in the background, yeah. You know what I mean? It's operating from there. This is the first year my mom and I have been able to talk about him. And like, of course, hers is tainted in where she thinks he's gone, like heaven and all of that. But mine is a very, just the calm that I've found.
Yeah, I mean, like, we talk about Fisher with my kids. Like, they know the story. They, like, know who he is. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, they'll talk about him, or, you know, we'll all be, like, doing what we call cuddle time. But trust me, it's very masculine. I'm hyper. It's very masculine. But we'll do that, and, like, me or my wife will be like, you know, I'd love to be here with my whole family. And one of them will be like, well, except for Fisher. Like, Fisher's not here. They're aware. They're aware that, like, there's a, that, you know, that there's like a negative space in the photographs. Like, they know that that is happening.
Yeah.
Do you have a concept of that? Is there like a place where you're like, and Sam is here, or is it very like, you know, super rational of like, he's dead and he's just, there is no Sam? Or.
Yeah. I mean, like I said earlier, unfortunately I'm 22. So my personality changes every day. But there was one point, especially when I was studying philosophy and like all of this materialism stuff, I was like, we all just become trees and we're atheists and fuck it all. But then that got way too fucking lonely and sad. So I think lately I've been thinking that there is, you know, there's at least maybe an energy or some ethereal spirit. I just watched all of Midnight Gospel, so it's really defining my opinions about things.
Okay.
But I'm like, I guess Sam must be like a spirit or some type of ether that is around me constantly and maybe is even guiding me in ways I don't think it watches. I don't think he's an observer, but I really do think feel like he's present. I don't know if it's... I get pretty spacey when I talk about this.
No,
stuff,
that's I think that's so interesting because I think it's a huge change from the way you seem to feel about it when it happened.
Yeah, yeah. It's just at least when I think Sam is around, I can be like, "Hey, what's up, dude?" And I can look up into a corner of the room and pretend like he's there, and that feels way more time than nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I think like again. It's like a separation of mind and heart where like my brain is still like, no, dude, he's dead. That's not, there's not a person. When you like think about, you know, I wish that he could see XYZ, he's not seeing it. But then there's another part of me that's like still tied to the idea of that person that will not, I mean, I guess I can't speak for the future, but I don't anticipate it ever becoming untied.
Yeah, it's just, I guess as I'm getting older now, I need some type of faith, some type of belief system. Again, like I said, just to fill my day, but I don't know. I need it.
That's so interesting. It's such a, like, to have undergone that change. The thing is not uncommon in people who have grieved, but you said earlier, and I've been thinking about this the whole time, but you said that thing about sort of perceiving femininity as like a weakness a little bit, like things that seemed like emotional or not strictly rooted in logic.
Yeah.
And then you even like made a passing comment about like me having to uphold masculinity. It just seemed like you identify so much with the opposite of that. And now like it's more like an acceptance of that thing that maybe you would have discounted before.
Yeah. And I mean, add this to my list of things that made me feel alone. But I grew up queer. I was, you know, a queer and came out in high school as a non-binary person because I felt like, one, I was lucky enough to grow up in a world where gender was being deconstructed already, so I was more open to the idea of it, but also was someone who was living in a body who felt like it didn't associate itself with femininity or masculinity, was kind of just in this middle ground. Even though I like to be femme presenting, there's still a non-binary quality to me. So I think I'm constantly on the lookout for the way our actions are affected because of the perceived gender construct that's happening above us or around us that we don't really realize. And for me, because I was reckoning with being a masculine and feminine person, I saw the femininity part as a weakness and masculinity part as a strength that I needed to inch towards. So I was like, I'm logical and I'm stoic and I'm rational and I'm not one of these little bitches out here. Like that was 100% how I moved. So yeah, it did color the way I acted to his death.
Yeah, I mean, this is such like a obvious thing to say, but it occurs to me how much, like for me, grief and loneliness really like begins and ends with Fisher. But for you talking about like growing up in a place where you're basically isolated and then feeling like, you know, you're different in so many ways, you, I would imagine, have been like looking for language to describe this thing or some things like this your whole life. Whereas for a lot of people who sort of feel like more mainstream in their environment, they don't have to develop that articulation about all the things that are happening around them.
Yeah, I think like I have mentioned this already that when I was on bereavement, I was like studying English and studying all of this kind of heavy theory stuff. I was in this poetry class and I had to tell all my it's so fucked up. It's like I was a sex offender. I had to go to every single teacher and be like, my brother is dead, just so you know. So here's a warning. I'm not going to be in class. Like I was obligated by the university to do that. And I went to my poetry teacher who was this like, he taught Victorian poetry and he was like an English dude who liked to wakeboard, like that kind of guy.
Beautiful.
And I walked up to him and I was like, you know, my brother passed, I can't be in class. And he goes, he touches my shoulder and he immediately apologizes because he's like, oh, it's 2017, I can't do this. But I'm so sorry, my brother also died and I just want you to know it's gonna be okay. And I was so fucking pissed at this dude because I'm like, you're on mile 17. You're on mile 26.
Right.
You're looking back at me who was still fucking stretching. Like I'm still trying to figure out why I'm even running today, bitch. I didn't want to run today. And now you're trying to get me to meet you where you're at. And like, that's not how grieving works. But he's in that stage of grief where he's dealt with it. So he just wants to help other people accelerate and get to that point. Like I had to figure out, and he gave me this poem. He gave me this like old poem called In Memoriam. It was like a Alfred Tennyson, like Victorian poem. It's, you know, the poem, you know, the phrase, 'tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all.
Yes.
This is from that poem. And it's just like a bunch of stanzas, dry ass stanzas of old Victorian shit that doesn't help anybody but
helped like Queen Victoria when she lost her spouse in like 1860. And he gave this to me, a queer Muslim black kid living in Nebraska who just lost her autistic brother. Like, there's so many facets to what I'm going through for you to just give me this bullshit ass. I needed a fucking like glossary to understand what the fuck it was saying. And he was like, this is going to help you a lot. Read this and you're going to feel great. And then I read it and felt absolutely nothing. And in like week one of grieving, I'm remembering that like, oh, everyone has a different stage of grief. And I'm looking at my future and I'm like, please, Aida, do not ever meet anyone who has lost someone and go, things are going to be okay. You're going to be fine. Like, no, just allow them to feel what they're feeling right now and be like a crater for that instead of this like an enzyme, like a catalyst for it. You don't need to speed up their grief. So that I just remembered him and he didn't help me at all and needed to share that with you.
You're only in year three. When you get to wherever he was, you may be passing out that poem. You know what I mean?
Oh my God, kill me. Shoot me. If I'm passing out that fucking poem, bro, that kill me.
It's 3 years now, 7 years from 7 years from now, so 10 years gone, you're going to have that Tennyson tattoo. That's going to be the tattoo. That's going to be, you know what I mean? You wanted to get that other tattoo? That'll be the other one.
Fuck. Do you ever catch yourself when you like, because there's this thing that happens when you're talking to someone who's also lost someone where you're like, and you find out they've lost someone, you're like, ah, oh, thank God. Like, ah, oh, they know what I've gone through. We can talk about this. I don't really want to talk to people who haven't lost people, but do you feel that connectivity?
Absolutely. And it's a thing that, like,
duh, the podcast.
Yeah, but it really is. It's like I didn't used to talk about it at all. But whenever you find out something like this from someone, it is like a link automatically. You know what I mean? It feels like, you know, it feels like, I don't know how to describe it. This is like a way less intense version of it, but like meeting another person who's half Filipino. It's like, okay, that's, you and I have this very specific thing in common.
Yeah.
But the thing that's crazy about grief is that it's like, everybody eventually is going to have some version of this. Like, not everyone will become half Filipino. I mean, as much as I pray for it.
Yeah, that's, I guess I hadn't thought about that. Is that if I wait long enough, everyone can join my grief club?
Yeah, they'll all be in it. You will know a person who dies for sure.
Yeah.
Aida, this has been amazing, if I dare say so.
Very healing. Thank you for having me on.
I had a great time. I feel like you've had an incredible time.
Checks out.
Thank you so much for doing this. That's Aida Osman. I'm Michael Cruz Kane. Thanks for listening. Love you. Bye. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.